This is Kathy bringing you the first half of the News Gazette for Friday, January the 9th. The lead article in the paper today is from the University of Illinois. It says, "I don't think I'm going to slow down. System preside Thursday that contract ends." From L. Taylor. University of Illinois System President Tom Killeen announced Thursday he'd be stepping down from the role at the end of his current contract, but he said there's plenty of work to be done before then. "I'm not slowing down anything. I'm accelerating," Killeen said. "Obviously, there's a lot of challenges and uncertainties in roles and responsibilities in higher education, but we got a model here that is exemplary, and I'm proud of it. I want to continue that development and then to be a seamlessly and graciously transition to new leadership." While he won't have direct involvement in the selection of the next U of I system president, Killeen said he expects to answer questions about the position and would be willing to suggest potential candidates if asked. His current contract isn't up until June 30th of 2027, so he still has quite a way to go before actually leaving the presidency. By that time, he will have been in that chair for 12 years. After that, he isn't sure of what the plan is just yet. He'll consult his family first, but expects to be finding new ways to work with and support young people, which he says is his passion. "I have a feeling I'm going to fail retirement," Killeen said. "I'm going to contribute something in arenas that I feel strongly about, certainly going forward, but I don't know what that's going to be. I don't think I'm going to slow down." Before becoming system president, Killeen was working as the vice chancellor for research and president of the Research Foundation of the State University of New York. He is often recognized for leading the U of I through the creation of the Discovery Partners Institute, the Illinois Innovation Network, and along with the state of Illinois, the Illinois Quantum and Microelectronics Park. Looking back over his time at the U of I thus far, he says he's the proudest of the forward momentum the university system currently has. Killeen highlighted an active alumni base and record-setting enrollment as well as graduation numbers. During his term, enrollment across the U of I system has grown, reaching a record 101,081 students across the three universities as of fall 2025. Counts of first-time freshman applications also made records this past fall at around 120,000. Over 27,000 students now graduate from the system each year. Killeen also pointed out how tuition costs haven't gone up in 7 of the last 11 years. "It's been something I'm proud of because I really wanted to make this world-class educational opportunity affordable, and that's not been easy to do in inflationary periods," Killeen said. "I'm proud of the fiscal strength that we've built. The spirit and culture of excellence and integrity is very strong. I'm inordinately proud of that. I can't take credit for any or all of this stuff." The U of I system will begin search for its next president in the coming weeks. This headline from the city of Monticello. Red Wheels buyer plans a restaurant / bar at the site. Also looking to open a liquor store coffee shop at the Farmer or Hardee's. By Jana Wersma. A restaurant right off Interstate 72 could reopen in the spring under new ownership. Vaishali Patel and her husband Nishid have purchased the former Monticello Red Wheel at 803 Iron Horse Place and are planning full renovation. According to Vaishali Patel, the tentative plan is to open a restaurant and high-end bar known as the Velvet Oak. She estimated that the business might open in mid-April or May. The restaurant will serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner, with a particular emphasis on the most important meal of the day. "We don't really have any sit-down places for breakfast as a group and a family-type thing," Patel said. "We have a couple of places, but not as many as we would like." The Monticello City Council is scheduled to vote Monday on whether to approve a Class A liquor license for the location, which would allow alcohol to be sold by the drink, as well as in retail packaging for consumption off-site. Patel said that the Velvet Oaks Bar will have items such as bourbon and tequila. "I want to have a specific type of alcohol which is more on a higher end to be able for customers to taste and have an opportunity to purchase the bottle after the fact," she said. Additionally, the restaurant has a good-sized room that she plans to make available for meetings, parties, and other private events. The City Council's agenda also includes a proposed agreement to reimburse the Patels for up to $5,500 for the cost of installing a security system before renovations begin, and a similar agreement for 309 North Market Street. The plan is to open a drive-through liquor store at the Market Street location as well as a coffee shop, Patel said. The shared location will be known as Blend and Brew, and she expects it to open around the same time as the Velvet Oak. As of right now, we're working back and forth with a coffee company where we would have a similar concept to, I guess, Dunkin' Donuts, but mom-and-pop version of it, she said. So you're able to get donuts, pastries, bite-to-eat sandwiches, and then varieties of coffee. The building, formerly a Hardee's, had its 5 minutes of fame in the summer of 2025 when it doubled as a filming location for the movie Chili Finger, which stars Judy Greer, Sean Astin, Bryan Cranston, and John Goodman. In addition to their projects in Monticello, the Patels own Super Lucky Star Food and Liquor in Urbana. Also on the City Council's agenda, a redevelopment agreement to reimburse up to $10,000 in construction costs for the new Just Hamburgers planned for 1056 South Market Street, just across the street from Monticello High School athletic facilities. Co-owner Todd Thornton declined to comment at this time. The proposed reimbursement agreement comes about 6 months after the Paxton-based burger joint announced its plans to open a Monticello location. In this front page article, it's called Episode 4 is Heard on News Gazette Radio. This first part of it, I still look at Camp Champaign as my hometown, said five-time Olympic speed skating gold medalist and Centennial Hall of Famer Bonnie Blair Cruikshank, who's off to Italy next month for the Milan Winter Games. Checking in from her home in Wisconsin on Thursday's show, Blair shared memories of the U of I Ice Arena. It has a big place in my heart. The welcome home receptions that awaited her after 4 closing ceremonies. Not sure a lot of other cities do that for other Olympians, even a former News Gazette sports writer who chronicled her one-of-a-kind career. Fred Croner was very good at his craft, and I was very good at my craft. But her most vivid recollections of those days involved the support of her sponsor, the Champaign Police Department. Long before she became the first American woman to win 5 Olympic gold medals, her family struggled to cover all of the expenses it took to train a future world record holder, trips to Europe, new skates, ice time, etc. She mentioned that at one time, then-CPD officer Jerry Swihart, the father of her good friend Tammy. Jerry's like, well, what would that take? And I'm like, I don't know, you'd have to ask my dad. So I met with Jerry and Danny Strand and my dad at the old Taffy's in Country Fair. My dad brought a shoebox of receipts and was like, well, this is the kind of what it takes for a year. And Jerry's like, I don't need to look in the shoebox. You just give me a number and we're going to figure out a way to get it done. And the rest is Olympic history. The Champaign Police Department was a big part of me being able to chase my goals and chase my dreams. It wasn't just opening up their checkbook and writing me a check. They did it from fundraisers around the community, so it was really like the whole community was involved in my success and my journey. It's something I'm eternally grateful for. The second one. A belated happy 93rd birthday to the namesake of the U of I's Lucy Liais Spirit Award, who pronounced it's a great time to be in the Illini. Kind of like it was with Mike White's football teams in the 80s, which produced one of Lulier's fondest memories. One of the highlights of my life was moving 4,500 people out to the Rose Bowl in 83, Liais said on Thursday's show. I'll never forget it. The former head of the U of I Alumni Association is a big Josh Whitman fan, and not just for the ascent of the high-profile programs in the athletic department he oversees. On TV, he's always hugging the players after the game, win or lose, Liais said. That's pretty touching for the AED to be at every game. I don't know how he does it. According to police data, shooting incidents in the city of Champaign in 2025 were down by 22 from a year ago and just one off the low total for the decade. There were 66 total incidents last year, one more than in 2023, and significant fewer than the 2 years that preceded it. 259 in 2021 and 129 in 2022. The one figure that didn't decrease, the number of homicides. 8 lives were lost to gunfire in 2025, the most since 16 people were shot and killed in Champaign in 2021. And area history. In 2011, unanticipated costs and unanswered questions have created the potential for a bigger price tag on the University of Illinois wind turbine project, and officials will wait at least until March to get approval from the U of I Board of Trustees. Project organizers originally hoped to get the okay from the board this month, but now they might need to find new sources of funding for the project that has stirred nearby residents worried about the 400-foot turbine's intrusiveness to their homes. And international history, today's highlight. On January 9, 2007, Apple CEO Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone at the Macworld Conference in San Francisco. And on this date in 1788, Connecticut ratified the U.S. Constitution and became the fifth U.S. state. In 1861, Mississippi became the second state to secede from the Union. The same day, the Star of the West, a merchant festival, bringing reinforcements and supplies to federal troops at Fort Sumter, retreated because of artillery fire. In 1916, the World War I Battle of Gallipoli ended with the Ottoman Empire victory as Allied forces withdrew. In 1945, during World War II, American forces began landing on the shores of the Ligayen Gulf in the Philippines as the Battle of Luzon got underway, resulting in an Allied victory over Imperial Japanese forces. In 2005, Mahmoud Abbas was elected president of the Palestinian Authority following the death of Yasser Arafat the previous November. In 2015, the two perpetrators of the shooting at the offices of Charlie Hebdo in Paris 2 days earlier were killed by police after a hostage crisis. In 2018, downpour sent mud and boulders roaring down Southern California hillsides that had been stripped of vegetation by a wildfire. More than 20 people died and hundreds of homes were damaged or destroyed. In 2022, 17 people, including 8 children, died after a fire sparked by a malfunctioning space heater filled a high-rise apartment building with smoke in the New York City borough of the Bronx. It was the city's deadliest blaze in 3 decades. New hope for ACA subsidies. House passes bill to extend expired health insurance help in defiance of GOP leaders. In a remarkable rebuke of Republican leadership, the House passed legislation Thursday, 230-196, that would extend expired health care subsidies for those who get coverage through the Affordable Care Act. As a renegade lawmaker, joined essentially all the Democrats in voting for the measure. Forcing the issue to a vote came about after a handful of Republicans signed on to a so-called discharge petition to unlock debate, bypassing objections from House Speaker Mike Johnson. The bill now goes to the Senate, where pressure is building for a similar bipartisan compromise. Together, the rare political coalitions are rushing to resolve the standoff over the enhanced tax credits that were put in place during the COVID-19 crisis, but expired late last year after no agreement was reached during the government shutdown. The affordability crisis is not a hoax. It is very real, despite what Donald Trump has had to say, said House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries, invoking the president's remarks. Democrats made clear before the government was shut down that we were in this affordability fight until we win this affordability fight. He said, today we have an opportunity to take a meaningful step forward. Ahead of voting, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that the bill, which would provide a 3-year extension of the subsidy, would increase the nation's deficit by about $80.6 billion over for the decade. At the same time, it would increase the number of people with health insurance by 100,000 this year, 3 million in 2027, 4 million in 2028, and 1.1 million in 2029, the CBO said. Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, worked for months to prevent this situation. His office argued Thursday that the federal health care funding from the COVID-19 era is ripe with fraud, pointing to an investigation in Minnesota, and urged a no vote. On the floor, Republicans argued that the subsidies as structured have contributed to fraud and that the chamber should be focused on lowering health insurance costs for the broader population. Only 7% of the population relies on Obamacare marketplace plans. This chamber should be about helping 100% of Americans, said Representative Jason Smith, the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. While the momentum from the vote shows the growing support for the tax breaks that have helped some 22 million Americans have access to health insurance, the Senate would be under no requirement to take up the House bill. Instead, a small group of senators from both parties has been working on an alternative plan that could find support in both chambers and become law. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said that for any plan to find support in his chamber, it will need to have income limits to ensure that the financial aid is focused on those who most need the help. He and other Republicans also want to ensure that the beneficiaries would have to at least pay a nominal amount for their coverage. Finally, Thune said there would need to be some expansion of health savings accounts, which allow people to save money and withdraw it tax-free as long as the money is spent on qualified medical expenses. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, who is part of the negotiations on reforms and subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, said there is an agreement in addressing fraud in health care. "We realize that we have millions of people in this country who are going to lose, are losing, have lost their health insurance because they can't afford the premium," Shaheen said. "And so we're trying to see if we can't help get to some agreement that's going to help. And the sooner we can do that, the better." Trump has pushed Republicans to send money directly to Americans for health savings accounts so they can bypass the federal government and handle insurance on their own. Democrats largely reject this idea as insufficient for covering the high costs of health care. The action by the Republicans to force a vote has been an affront to Johnson and his leadership team, who essentially lost control of what comes to the House floor as the Republican lawmakers join Democrats for the workaround. After last year's government shutdown failed to resolve the issue, Johnson had discussed allowing more politically vulnerable GOP lawmakers a chance to vote on another health care bill that would temporarily extend the subsidies while also adding changes. But after days of discussions, Johnson and the GOP leadership sided with the more conservative wing, which has assailed the subsidies as propping up ACA, which they consider a failed government program. He offered a modest proposal of health care reforms that was approved but has stalled. It was then that the rank-and-file lawmakers took matters into their own hands, as many of their constituents faced soaring health insurance premiums beginning this month. Republican Representatives Brian Fitzpatrick, Robert Bresnahan, and Ryan McKenzie, all from Pennsylvania, and Mike Lawler of New York, signed the Democrats' petition, pushing it to the magic number of 2018, needed to force a House vote. All four represent key swing districts whose races will help determine which party takes charge of the House next year. Senate pushes back on Trump's Venezuela threats. The Senate advanced a resolution Thursday that would limit President Donald Trump's ability to conduct further attacks against Venezuela, sounding a note of disapproval for his expanding ambitions in the Western Hemisphere. Democrats and five Republicans voted to advance the War Powers Resolution on a 52-47 vote and ensure a vote next week on final passage. It has virtually no chance of becoming law because Trump would have to sign it if it were to pass the Republican-controlled House. Still, it was a significant gesture that showed unease among some Republicans after the U.S. military seized Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro in a surprising nighttime raid over the weekend. Trump's administration is now seeking to control Venezuela's oil resources and its government, but the War Powers Resolution would require congressional approval for any further attacks on the South American country. "To me, this is all about going forward," said Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, one of the five Republican votes. "If the president should determine, you know what, I need to put troops on the ground in Venezuela, I think that would require Congress to weigh in." The other Republicans who backed the resolution were Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, and Todd Young of Indiana. Trump reacted to their votes by saying on social media that they should never be elected to office again, and that the vote greatly hampers American self-defense and national security. Democrats had failed to pass several such resolutions in the months that Trump escalated his campaign against Venezuela. But lawmakers argued now that Trump has captured Maduro and set his sights on other conquests such as Greenland. The vote presents Congress with an opportunity. "This wasn't just a procedural vote. It's a clear rejection of the idea that one person can unilaterally send American sons and daughters into harm's way without Congress and without debate," said Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York. And this editorial: "With Maduro deposed, real work just beginning. Former General Colin Powell once warned that if you break it, you own it. Will that apply in Venezuela?" The American people know that what early January 3rd, U.S. military forces conducted a raid during which they seized Venezuelan president, an accused narco trafficker, Nicolas Maduro, and took him to New York for trial. One newspaper editorial called the action an act of hemispheric hygiene against a dictator who spread mayhem far and wide. Obviously, not all share that view of President Donald Trump's bold action. The question now is, what's next? Aye, there's the rub. Trump has asserted that the U.S. will run Venezuela until that country's legitimately elected president assumes power. Someone is already available to fulfill that duty, the candidate who won the 2024 election, ultimately stolen by Maduro. But there's more to running a country than just having a president. Maduro's criminal infrastructure remains in place, and the individuals who run it won't voluntarily step aside. What then? Many will speculate, but no one knows. The path ahead includes many obstacles. For starters, Venezuela is an impoverished country despite ample oil resources that make it rich on paper. Further, it has lived under successive dictators, Hugo Chavez and Maduro, and history shows that creating a democracy out of despotism is easier said than done. The Venezuelan people will not miss Maduro, but there's no guarantee they will be happy with who takes his place. Improvement, like rebuilding the country's beleaguered oil industry, will take time and patience. In authorizing the seizure of Maduro, Trump ironically bowed to previous wishes of powerful Democrats, like U.S. Senators Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin. Both are extremely critical of Trump for not confronting Maduro in a more aggressive fashion. The president brags about his Venezuela policy. Give us a break. He hasn't brought an end to the Maduro regime. The Maduro regime is more powerful today and more entrenched today than it was when the president began, Schumer said during Trump's first term. Durbin made similar assertions, saying at the same time that the people of Venezuela deserve better than this. We can't allow this president's short attention span to stop us from delivering on our promise to help the Venezuelan people rebuild their country. President Joe Biden offered a $25 million reward for Maduro's capture. Given Schumer and Durbin's stances, then, it's hard to credit their equally critical comments now. Trump has that kind of effect on his political opponents. The domestic U.S. response, however, is just the usual noise that comes and goes in an election year. But that does not diminish the seriousness of the issue this nation faces. Restoring Venezuela and its people to a safe and prosperous country that operates on democratic principles. Maduro and his henchmen were never going to do that. And that is an editorial. Illinois Democrats seek Kristi Noem's impeachment. Recalling parallels to aggressive federal immigration enforcement tactics in the Chicago region last fall, top Illinois Democrats called for Department of Homeland Security Security Secretary Kristi Noem's ouster after a federal immigration agent fatally shot a woman under questionable circumstances at Minneapolis on Wednesday. U.S. Representative Robin Kelly, Democrat of Linwood, who is running in the Democratic primary for retiring Senator Dick Durbin's seat, said she plans to file articles of impeachment against Noem. She has turned ICE into a rogue force, violating the Constitution, tearing families apart, and leaving death in her wake, Kelly said in a statement. From Chicago to Minneapolis, her recklessness costs lives, including Renee Nicole Good. This isn't just dangerous, it's impeachable. I'm fighting back. Alongside Kelly is her Democratic primary opponent, Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy, a Democrat from Schaumburg, who wrote on social media that I'll be your first co-sponsor. When federal agents are unleashed without restraint or oversight, the consequences are daily, and the responsibility from this killing is on their hands, he said, adding that he will be demanding full answers and accountability from the Trump administration. The third leading candidate in that Senate race, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, said Noem should resign or be removed, adding, "We won't let you get away with this." Kelly's impeachment push is likely symbolic at this point, due to the Democrats' minority status in the U.S. House, and removal doesn't appear likely either, as Trump and the Republicans in his administration and Congress put out statements backing the ICE officer's conduct. Good, 37, was killed by a federal immigration agent while apparently attempting to flee a traffic stop. DHS, in a statement, said she weaponized her vehicle and attempted to run over agents in an act of domestic terrorism, while the officer, fearful for his life, fired defensive shots. However, multiple videos of the incident directly contradict the Trump administration's narrative by showing Good driving away from, not toward, the officer when he opened fire, raising doubts about the necessity of using lethal force. The ICE agent was later seen on video walking around the scene with no apparent injuries, even though Trump said on social media the officer was hospitalized. Trump deemed the victim a domestic terrorist. For Illinois elected leaders, there was a sense of deja vu as the accounting of the fatal shooting echoed patterns in two shootings involving immigration officers during the height of Operation Midway Blitz in the Chicago region last year. Severio Villegas Gonzalez was fatally shot by ICE agents in Franklin Park in September after attempting to flee a traffic stop. As in Good's case, DHS said that Villegas Gonzalez tried to use his vehicle as a weapon, that agents feared for their lives, acting in self-defense, and were seriously injured. But body cam footage later obtained by the Chicago Sun-Times found that the ICE officers deemed their injuries as nothing major. In October, Marimar Martinez was shot by a federal agent in Chicago's Brighton Park neighborhood. DHS called her a domestic terrorist who used her car as a weapon, but evidence poked holes in that narrative and federal charges against her were dropped. Governor J.B. Pritzker, speaking at in an unrelated bill signing Wednesday morning, said that we've seen this playbook before, casting the federal government's version of events in Orwellian terms. Kristi Noem and Donald Trump have told the Americans to disbelieve clear, indisputable video evidence, Pritzker said. They want you to question what your eyes and ears are telling you and instead blindly believe anything that they say. The governor then encouraged people to watch videos of the incident for themselves. ICE is not making Minneapolis safer, just as it did not make Chicago safer, U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth said, calling the shooting horrific and saying the agency's behavior needs to stop. Durbin, in a statement, said that a full investigation must be completed so the truth can be revealed. Video of the incident starkly contradicts DHS's narrative, and the fact that DHS has jumped to characterize this shooting in self-defense is rushed at best and a lie at worst, he said. Durbin, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, called on his Republican counterparts to issue a subpoena to compel Noem to testify before the committee. Capital News, Illinois. Pritzker signs major energy reform bill amid projected shortages, by Maggie Doherty. Amid warnings of impending energy shortages, Governor J.B. Pritzker on Thursday signed a wide-ranging energy reform package into law aimed at bolstering the state's power grids after years of negotiations. Senate Bill 25, also known as the Clean and Reliable Grid Affordability Act, or CRGA, will fund battery storage, grant greater authority to state utility regulators, create new options for virtual power plants, and lift a longtime ban on new large-scale nuclear power plants. We're making it easier to develop renewable energy, bill sponsor Senator Bill Cunningham, Democrat of Chicago, said at the signing ceremony in Joliet. We're going to deploy battery storage. We're lifting the nuclear moratorium. That's all going to bring more supply onto the grid, and that will help hold the line on our electrical bills. The Illinois Power Agency, an independent body responsible for planning and procuring cost-effective energy for Illinoisans, found that the law will save utility customers in the state $13.4 billion over the next two decades. But opponents question those projections, pointing to increased subsidies for battery storage that will eventually be reflected via a new charge on consumers' bills beginning in 2030. The bill signing took place less than a month after the state regulators projected energy shortfalls would likely drive up costs in the next 3 to 5 years and force Illinois to import more power from out of state absent action from lawmakers and grid operators. Shortfalls, Pritzker said, would be exacerbated by actions at the national level, including the Trump administration's passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which phased out renewable energy tax credits and froze federal funding for energy projects. He also criticized a Trump executive order that stripped funding for the Inflation Reduction Act, a major renewable energy law passed by Congress in 2022. All that raises prices in the short term while threatening our long-term ability to meet growing electricity demand, Pritzker said. CRGA, he said, will allow Illinois to forge its own path. At the core of the law is a new structure to incentivize energy storage or battery projects. It will result in new charges to ratepayers, though supporters of the bill say that those costs would be offset by cost savings from greater energy efficiency, storing, and planning. The law grants new authority to the Illinois Commerce Commission, the state body responsible for regulating utilities. The ICC will now have the power to set long-term plans for managing energy supply and demand in the state through approval of an integrated resource plan. That'll be all for part one of the News Gazette for Friday, January the 9th. Stay tuned for part two.